What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Shadow Band Podcast. Once again, we are super happy that you guys are here listening to us. I don't know why you still listen to us, but you do. So we're grateful. We've got Mr. Creamer in the house with us today. I know everybody loves Creamer. Creamer, what's up, buddy? How we doing?
Hanging in there. I got a little health issue going on. It feels like COVID. And I say if it feels like COVID and it hurts like COVID, it's probably the flu. So I think that's what I have.
Creamer's got the monkeypox. So, you know. Keep them in your thoughts. And the charming young man that you hear laughing at Creamer and having his monkeypox right now is the one and only, the legend. Okay, somebody I'm super excited to talk to right now. We've got the one and the only Tommy Chong on the show with us. Tommy.
Hey, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Sit down. Everybody sit down.
No, we want standing ovations. Yes,
no,
yes.
Standing.
Like I said, right before I hit the record button, you know, we're just going to have an organic conversation. Sorry for anybody listening today that just really wants like the deep dive on whatever chemtrails or whatever. We might get into it, but we're just going to talk to Tommy, man. This is an honor to have him on the show. So we're just going to kind of shoot the shit and see what comes out of it. But Tommy, what's up, man? Tell everybody how you're doing.
Well, I'm doing great. You know, I've just got a clean bill of health from my doctor. You know, my wife was a little worried, especially with the COVID. Oh, by the way, my wife, we've always passed all the tests, you know, that we did. But my wife tells people, oh, we've had COVID. And I look at her, I go, she goes, oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we passed the test, but I know it was COVID, you know. I love that, you know, she's so sure of her own diagnosis, right. Now, if the guy had said that we had it, she might have said, oh no, that can't be right. I don't think she would have done that, but she cracks me up. I mean, I love her to death, but there are some, you learn, you know, people want to know, we've been together, you know, over 50 years, that's how long we've been together. And someone asked me, you know, what's the secret of a good marriage? And lately it's been two television sets. That's the secret. That'll keep you together.
That's funny, man. Wow, I wish I knew that secret of my first marriage, right? Jeez.
Yeah, you would still been married.
Oh, that's good. Maybe it's good that we didn't have two TVs then. No, that is funny, man. And it's funny that she says that you guys had it and you guys made it through without knowing for sure. It seems to me that that's probably how they're calculating all the numbers for all of that shit. But, you know, that, what do I know? You know,
it's a lazy way to do it, man. Come on, do the test. And if the test says you got it, you got it. And if the test says you don't got it, you don't got it. That's simple. It's you know, it's not, well, I don't like the way they stuck it up my nose or something. I don't know. And then I got other friends, you know, that won't get, you know, well, she had to get a vaccine, but they were deniers, you know, because they listened to all the wrong bullshit, you know. So, no, I'm a great believer in science, and I'm a great believer in listening to experts, you know, because that's why they got these great looking offices and you know, staff with uniforms and shit like that. You know, it takes a lot of money to be on top of the world like that, you know, being an expert and then risking your life. These are doctors, man. Think about it, man. You know, the doctors, you know, they have masked up and regardless of what it is, because they know how dangerous it is to be around sick people.
That is true.
And that's what doctors do for a living, man. They're around sick people all the time.
Just walking.
You know, so
time, like they're sterile all the time.
Yeah. It's more than habit. It's a total necessity. But when you get older, especially my age, because I'm at that really, how did I make it this far?
What are you, 29 now, Tommy? 30?
Yeah. No, I'm at that age where you pass a point where you start, where you quit lying about it and you start bragging about it.
Take advantage. Who's the comedian? I forget which comedian it was, but he had a joke about when I get to be like 80, I'm just going to start shoplifting all the time. I forget whose line that is, but that shit always cracked me up. Like, just get away with it. Just say you're senile. I'll be like, I didn't know.
You can get away with a lot when you're older. And actually, you there's a lot of things you can get away with. You got to be very careful, especially when it comes to sexuality. I had to shut down. I used to be the most loud, sexist joke, all sorts of weird stuff going on. And man, as soon as I hit 80 or, got up there, I had to shut that one down, because nothing more pathetic than an old sex pervert. Because it's like, don't you know by now how to control that urge, dude?
I guess you're probably right. Times have changed too, not to say that anything necessarily was right back in the days, but times definitely changed. You definitely got to be more careful about how you interact with people in today's day and age.
What you say? I was checking. I remember, what Cheech and I, the shows that we had. There's no holds barred. You could get away with anything. And if you watch the old All in the Family with Meathead and they were down and dirty. They got down with it, Archie Bunker, he was like the first Trumpy, and wow, I watch that show now and it's like, whoa, you could never get away with it.
I was watching clips of was Married with Children with Al Bundy.
Yes.
That dude would eviscerate people.
Yes.
But
yes.
I'm even like blushing a little bit, the stuff he's saying. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yes.
A little rough for me, dude. This guy is crazy.
They don't make them like they used to.
Network TV.
Yeah, we're going back there. You see, what it was is that people were prejudiced and they were racist and everything else, but they weren't ashamed of it. They were actually proud of it. And like the Rat Pack, with Dean Martin, they made all these racist jokes about Sammy Davis Jr. And Sammy, he just hung in there. He was just glad to be, friends with everybody. Because, you see, back then, being Black was as dangerous, more dangerous then than now. Now, cops will go to jail if you kill a Black person. But back then, it wouldn't even make the news. There'd be all lynchings and all sorts of shootings and stuff like that. They had that back in the day. They always, some, Black guy got killed, and they always found a gun on him nearby, and the gun was always untraceable.
Convenient.
And sometimes reusable, with the cops. But now, oh man, it's all in the open now. It's all even hairdos. Back in the day, I was with a Black band from the 50s, and I watched. We had a singer. He was a football player, excellent football player, very fast Black guy, descendant of slaves from Texas, and I watched him when we put the band together. He had natural hair, it was all, like they are today, but as soon as he became a singer, he started straightening his hair, and it changed his, not only changed his look, but it changed his personality. he went from being happy and laughing and free to being moody and pouty and you know, serious, and was just a hairdo because they were back in the day in the 50s, 60s, you know, they straightened their hair. They had some compound that would straighten their hair, and it was lye. It was actually lye. And it would burn, if you left it on too long, it would burn the shit out of your head. And I watched these guys go through that they did it. Yeah.
I used to put it in, and then you leave it on too long and just eat the skin right off. And then,
you know,
you have like super floppy, wavy hair. I was like, wow.
yeah. What people do for style, you know, and it wasn't to me, I used to think at one time, you know, it was because of the female, but no, it was the guys that wanted to look that way. And it gave them that sort of like a Jackie Wilson pimp look, you know, you got that conk in the right place and you had an attitude to go with it, you know. And then the rappers came along and blew that all apart, you know. That's all gone now.
Yeah, hip-hop definitely changed culture, in my opinion, in a lot of ways. Some good, some definitely not good, but it's kind of wild. This is why I shave my head, so that I don't have an identity, right? It's just it's like a mystery box. Every day I'm whoever I want to be. I don't have a hairdo to attach myself to an identity.
You don't mind looking like a penis?
No, not at all. I love it. It's my favorite thing. That's what I go for in the morning. I look in the mirror and I'm like, I'm gonna look like a cock today, and I just go for it.
I started out with Chinese hair. My dad was Chinese, and so he gave me a home. We got home cut. You know, what do you call it? Home style.
Do it yourself.
Haircuts. Yeah. Oh yeah. Not with electric either. With the clippers.
Oh no.
Oh man, that hurt. Ooh. And when my girlfriend, now wife Shelby, when she told me, "Grow your hair long," that was the nicest thing anybody ever said to me. Because I haven't looked back. That was in the 60s. In the 60s, I met Jimi Hendrix, and then changed everything. We changed the way we dress, our hair, our look, style, everything.
Yeah,
everything changed.
I've heard you changed. I've heard you talk about this before. Maybe you could give us like the brief story about you. Didn't you jam with Hendrix at one point?
Yeah.
Could you give us that little tidbit?
Well, I found out, you know, later that Hendrix used to do this a lot with groups, because he, in fact, I found out just recently, this another friend of mine, Guitar Shorty, he was older than both Hendrix and I, and when I started listening, you know, I listened to T-Bone Walker Jr. T-Bone Walker, and then Guitar Shorty was billing himself back in the day as T-Bone Walker Jr. And again, that was in the late 50s, early 60s. And then Hendrix used to follow Guitar Shorty around and picked up his style. That's how Jimmy got his style from Guitar Shorty. So, in my band in Vancouver, we were close enough to Seattle. People knew about us from Seattle, but I had no idea to what extent, because when you're a musician, all you know about is really how many people that can play much better than you.
Oh yeah.
and with me, I'm getting away with it, you know. Partly because I own the club. And so I couldn't be fired that way. And also, we always had a better guitar player in the band, you know, so the pressure wasn't on me to be a good guitar player. But anyway, Hendrix, we were in London, England, playing, backing up Chris Clark for Berry Gordy. And as a reward, they got us a gig, a little side gig at a place called Speakeasy in London, England. And it was just a gig with Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. It was a dance gig. And so we're playing, and Hendrix walked in with his entourage. First of all, there was nobody in the club. It was empty. And then Hendrix walked in with about 200-300 people behind him.
Whoa.
Boom. He filled the place. Then he walked up to the stage and he called me by name. He said, "Hey, Tom, mind if I sit in?" And I had such an urge to go, maybe the last set, Jimmy, you know, we got to work out some of our own tunes first. That was the usual, what they would usually tell people. But of course, I took out my guitar and Hendrix goes, no, I'll play bass, because he's a left-handed guitar player. And so he played bass and we jammed and played all night. It was the biggest thrill of my life. The only guy who wasn't happy was a bass player. He had to sit and watch us.
that's amazing, dude. I can't even imagine how that would be. I mean, I've played a lot of shows. I've been in bands and I've shared the stage with like some of the people that I look up to in the music industry. So, and that was awesome, but I could not imagine jamming with Hendrix. That'd be insane.
What was your instrument?
Guitar. I play a seven string.
Oh, guitar too.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Rhythm or lead?
I'm a rhythm player. I play a little bit of leads, but yeah. I'm definitely not a lead player.
That's me. I don't apologize for it. In fact, I'm very proud that I was a very good rhythm guitar player all my life. That's how I worked, you know. But yeah, Hendrix. And then here's the weird thing. After that, the next day we're in a limousine. By the way, it was a limousine that the Beatles were using at one time. And so everything was historic. Hendrix playing with us. Now we're in the Beatles limo and we're driving to the airport. And everybody was saying, "Man, Jimi Hendrix, man, we play with Jimi Hendrix." And for some reason, I blurted out, I swear to God, I said, "I'm going to be bigger than Hendrix one day." And can you imagine the whole band? Everybody got quiet and they all did that slow look at me like, "Are you crazy?" I talked to the guitar player not too long ago, a couple of years ago actually, and I asked him if he remembered. He's all, "Oh, man, are you kidding? I remember that as clear as I'll never forget that." Yeah, because I actually said that. But that shows, and that was before I did any comedy or people that really didn't know that I spoke. You know, because, you know, I was a rhythm guitar player.
Right.
And you know, other than nodding at the band or what key are we in, you know, there was not much to say, you know. So when I became a comedian, it shocked the hell out of a lot of people. The guy can talk too, you know.
What caused you to switch over?
I came across a guitar player that was so good. I just, you know, and he was the one that got me into comedy. His name was Gay DeLorme. He passed away, but he was one of the greatest guitarists in the world. And I'm not, you know, I had a night alone with Wes Montgomery one time. He was playing in this jazz club and I was the only sober, only guy awake. Everybody is in Vancouver. Everybody's passed out. They're all junkies, you know. And he had a second show to do. And so Wes came out, I was the only guy there. And I'm a guitar player. So we sat and talked about guitars for about a half hour, maybe 45 minutes. And then he said, "Well, I better play." And then he played. And I was the only guy there listening to him. But anyway, Gay DeLorme came along. And I got fired from Motown because they really didn't need me. They had the singer. That's all they needed, you know. And I was trying to get a green card. And so I had to leave the gig for the side gig that we had. And the road manager told me, "If you leave, then you're fired." You know, and I didn't pay any attention to him because I'd never really listened. I never had a road manager before, you know. I either owned the club or owned the group, or, you know, I was up there. So anyway, as soon as I came back to the gig, and I was fired. And so I took my pathetic little guitar. And it was kind of pathetic too, because the band could have saved me. You know that kind of band.
Like, oh no, you're going to be bigger than Jimmy. You'll be fine.
That's but they didn't say anything. They just wouldn't look me in the eyes. Just turned. They looked every which way, and so I got fired. But then in the meantime, when I was on the road, I used to go to improv groups like the Second City, and there was a group in LA called the Committee, and it was a committee that I went in San Francisco, and so I was really, you know, that was really what interests me was the improvisational acting. And so when I came back to Vancouver, to I had two nightclubs at that time, and both were given to me because they weren't making money, and at least I'm making money. So I came back, and my aim was to, you know, find another band, basically, you know. I thought about it, but I got interested in acting, so I started. We had a club. It was a strip club, a titty bar, and I turned it into an improvisational nightclub, using the girls as actresses. And the guitar player, Gate Alarm, he was the one that wrote the first bit for us. He wrote the funniest bit, and it was hilarious. And so so then I realized, you know, and I had an actor playing the role, but he quit the first night. It was too much work for him. And so I asked the doorman, I says, I need an MC. And the doorman says, I'll do it if you do it. And so it was Dave. His name was Dave. That's where Dave's Not Here came from. But sure enough, you know, I started acting. And then as soon as I started acting, I found that, you know, this is really what I'm good at, you know. And the guitar player, Gate Alarm, he stood back and he wrote the whole bit for us. And then he had a band called Jangle, and they would play. And they would literally play maybe three tunes a night, but they were like 45 minute long tunes, you know. Ooh. And it was like really, it was jazz, but with a Hendrix sound, you know. He could play Hendrix better than Hendrix. You know, it was amazing. In fact, toward the end of his life, he'd get hired and they just want him to solo. They just said, you know, here, whatever you want, just go, just solo on stage. He was a great guy, very, very Canadian, very funny. His humor, Cheech and I used his humor throughout our whole career. You know, there's so many of it. The song he wrote called Me and My Old Lady, it was in... Things Are Tough All Over, the movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a few. And he wrote, Gay wrote the title track for that particular movie. And I've when you meet a guitar player like that, I mean, literally, I just said, there's no way, you know, I could ever come close to that. And you know what his secret was? He started off playing steel guitar. Mm. And when you play steel guitar, that's single note stuff, you know, you have to know every note and you have to know the tune. You know, rhythm guitar player, you can play around with chords, you can cheat your way through a song with no problem. But when you're, you know, a soloist, like a harp player, or, you know, or piano player, man, you got to know your instrument.
Yeah, I'm getting sweaty just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Well, that's wild, dude, honestly. And how does it feel to know, and I don't know if you feel this way, but in my opinion, I would say you probably are bigger than Jimi Hendrix at this point. No disrespect to Jimmy, but I mean, yeah. Dude, you're up there. So how does that feel to speak that into the universe and see it come through?
It's very, very humbling. Mm. Very humbling, you know, because it's such it's not a crapshoot getting to where I'm at. You just have to be true to who you are. And when you find out who you are, that you know, it's a divine intervention. You know, I mean, like I especially now, you know, doing a lot of podcasts and that, you know, and reminiscing, talking about what happened. And what I found, I got hooked up spiritually at a very, very early age. I've told this story many times, but I never get tired of telling it because it's the truth. You know, it's what really happened to me. I was, my mother and I were separated soon after I was born. She ended up with TB. And so she got isolated for 5 years, total isolation. We couldn't go near her for 5 years. My dad just came from the war, Second World War. And so he was in no condition to look after a family. And so I ended up in the hospital because they found pleurisy on my lung. And so I was in the hospital for about a year. And then my brother, my older brother and my younger sister, they were put into a orphanage, a home, Salvation Army home. And so when I got out of the hospital, I spent a year in the hospital. And when I got out of the hospital, I was shuttled right over to the Salvation Army home. Now, you know, and I was preschool, you know, it was like before grade one. And so I guess I was about 5 years old. And so I had that sort of like incarcerated feeling. That's why when I went to jail years later, it was like going back, it was like a reunion, going back to the old way, what I grew up with. But when I was in the Salvation Army home, it started there, I guess, because before breakfast, before we ate or anything, they sang hymns, and they did it was kind of militant. But that's why they call it Salvation Army, you know, because they weren't messing around, you know. They're the ones that popularized onward Christian soldiers marching off to war. Years later, I found out that wasn't really Jesus' intent to change the world into Christianity, you know. But I found that out later. But early on, and then when my mother got out of the hospital and we had our little cottage on the edge of Calgary, Alberta, Canada. The only entertainment, the only reason we had to dress up was to go to church, Sunday school for the kids. And I loved Sunday school because, you know, it was fun. You got to meet people, you know, see other people and dress up and hear stories about, you know, wonderful Sunday school stories, you know, all about love and kindness and sweetness. And one time in Sunday school, the teacher was saying about God is everywhere. And I remember walking home that night because we walked miles across the field, you know, in the country. And I remember walking home and looking. God is everywhere. Is that God? God walking, you know, in the shadows or, you know, kind of looking. And so I remember saying to myself, you know, okay, God, where are you? And then for some unknown reason, but I guess it was like the spirit, my head went up, looked up at the night sky, and it was spectacular. The Milky Way was just hanging right over me. I could see comets. I could see all this action going on. And I didn't put the two together, you know, asking where God is and then being shown, you know, the handiworks, the heavens. I didn't put that together until just recently. But then I realized that for some reason, there was something going on that was way beyond my control. Soon after that, I think that maybe the next summer, my brother and I were walking down a dirt road, you know, barefoot, and a car pulled up, and it was full of missionaries, and they said, "Hey, you boys want to go to summer camp?" And we said, "Yeah." And so he went, they drove us back to our parents, and we got permission from my mother. My dad was always on the road. And so I went to Bible camp for 2 weeks. And the first night, they teach you how to pray. And wow, that opened another whole world for me. And I've been using that ever since. And during the Bible camp, I just blossomed. I loved every minute of it. You know, now my brother, I never saw my brother. Well, I never really did. He was 3 years older than me, so he always hung out with the older kids. And I was just like a thing that he had to take care of, you know, when he remembered, you know, hey, don't forget your brother, look after your brother. But I just got this really deep spiritual connection with God, and I've used it all my life, and especially lately, you know, with cancer and the thing, the way the spirit works is that it's called intuition, gut feeling. They got all these things, you know. If you're doing wrong, if you're going down the wrong way, you get a nudge. You get nudged. But it's not a nudge of danger. It's a nudge of excitement. It could be an adrenaline rush, you know, because you know you're going down the wrong path and you're going to pay for it, you know, that kind of thing. But I managed. And then the other thing I learned is that praying for others is what really works on you, because that really is our job on earth, is to look after others.
Man.
that's why we're here. And it's how we treat others that determines what we have to learn next, because there's no right or wrong in what we're doing. Just like there's no devil, there's no evil, there's just the absence of good. And the nicer you are to others, the more good becomes available to you.
And that karmic wheel, man, you gotta fill up that karma cup, right?
Totally. And it's not a wheel where it says, well, you built up enough credits that you can do something. No, it doesn't work that way. You know, it's like, well, you know what it is? Biblically speaking, the Bible says God created everything that was good, and everything that God did not create was not created. So evil basically is an illusion, you know, just like a lie. A lie is anybody can lie because it's created. The liar creates the lie, and because God never created the lie, it's a lie. It's not created, and that's why lies always come back and go, come home, you're the only home, it's God. You know, when you send that lie out, it comes back to you because it can't land anywhere else. It's a lie, and you're the father of the lie, so it comes back to you. And that's karma again, you know, that's karma. What goes around, comes around. And but the goodness part, that's something we're supposed to do. So it's like walking, you know, you're not supposed to limp, you're supposed to walk, you know. And when you do it properly, it's no big deal. And so when you're doing your life properly, if you're helping others and content with what you have, knowing that whatever you need will be given to you, then you've reached nirvana. You've reached the point of happiness, and it doesn't matter what's going on with your life in the physical world, because what I found out is that there, in order for one thing to exist, the opposite has to exist. You can't have one without the other in the physical world, for sure. In the spiritual world, there is only spirit. There's only love. That's why the spirit world, I just figured out, it's been said, poets have talked about it, you know, about the 400 angels on the head of a pin, you know, that kind of thing. Because I realized just from my pot smoking and you know, just thinking, you know, just leave my mind open, and these answers come. And one of the answers is, and everything, there's no secrets. Everything is right in front of our face. You can have all the conspiracies in the world, but basically, you look at it and say, yeah, there's nothing secret about it. The physical world is enormous. It's growing. That kills me when I saw that Hubble show on the Hubble spacecraft, and they picked a little part of the heavens that was looked empty, and they went in there, and what did they find? They found something like 10 zillion more galaxies in that one little spot the size of a dime. and that's just one spot, and you know, and so the physical world is, and we're just part of one million universes. There's millions of zillions of universes. So the enormous size of the physical world is mind-boggling. The opposite. What's the opposite? What's the opposite of everything? Nothing. So the spiritual world, really, because the spirit world is only consists of love, and so, and we are eternal beings. You've always been here. I've always been here, in one form or another, consciously, you know. And that's why we're here. We're here to learn. You can't learn in the spiritual world. There's nothing to learn. You got everything. There's no need, desire, nothing. But humans are put here to reproduce. There's another word for it, but I can never remember it. But that's why we're here. That's our job, is to reproduce. Now, not all of us are here to reproduce, obviously, because some of us don't have the equipment to reproduce. But we're just as needed as anybody else, you know.
Creamer's a good example of that.
What's that?
I said Creamer's a good example of that. I'm just kidding, Creamer. Creamer's got beautiful kids.
But that's our job. That is our job, is to reproduce. Now, is everybody going to be perfect? No, because that's another thing too. When you go to school, you don't know the curriculum. That's why you're going to school. You're going to school to learn, you know. So when people figure you should know better, well, you don't, because you haven't been taught. If you're going down the wrong path, you don't know it. You haven't been taught. Or if you're going down the wrong path and that's the path you want to go, well, that's your karma. That's the mistake you need to do. Because there's another saying, you know, we only learn from our mistakes. And that's so true. That's so true. And if you keep making the same mistake over and over again, well, again, there's no end to it. We live in an eternal world. We can make the same mistake for eons and eons and eons. And then one day you'll learn.
Like, I'm stuck in that loop a lot of the time. I'm like, dang, man, isn't this the thing I was going through 2 years ago?
Yeah. Forget it, actually. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? What I'm saying is that there's no secrets. And that you know, there's conspiracies, and I love conspiracies. I didn't meet Alex Jones, but I was on his show one time. because he did a bit when the 9/11 buildings came down, that some of those buildings looked like they were rigged to come down because of the way they collapsed, you know. Mm-hmm. And they had an architect say, well, that looks like when you demolish a building, you know, they go down by the stairs, it happens a certain way. And so I fell for it, you know. That makes sense, because I'm a seeker, you know. I'll fall for that. And then, you know, of course, that turned out not to be the case. But what I learned, that's the thing. I love being on these shows because that's the only time that I really talk about is when I'm asked, because that's the hardest lesson in the world, you know, to shut the fuck up, you know, because that's the worst thing. That's what the old wise ones do. You see the old wise gurus, you know, they don't talk unless they're asked. And if they're asked, they'll give you that little bit of wisdom. Just enough to fill your cup. And you go, okay, that sounds right. Because they also know that you can't teach people, because they got to learn themselves. You know, you got to learn this stuff yourself. And that's why we're in the state we're in. But if you look at the enormous size of the universe, our own, just own Milky Way, it makes you wonder where do we stand in, you know, what I guess Earth is, it's got to be a place. Yeah, I guess. It's a very special place. We're finding out it's so special, and we're finding out that we are so special. The more we look into it, the more we find that out. You know?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that for sure. And to kind of circle back to the fill the karma cup thing up, I told my dad that I would tell you hi for him, and that he's a huge fan of yours, and that my upbringing was greatly influenced by the culture that you helped to start back in the 70s. So shout out to Dad. It's also Father's Day yesterday, so got to throw that.
What does Dad do? Is he still with us?
Oh yeah, he's still here. He's still around. Just talked to him. I talked to him a week or two ago. Once we set this up, I was like, "Hey man, I'm talking to Tommy Chong," and he was like, "Oh, yeah.
That's so great."
Yeah, he's a big fan.
Is so great. I love our fans, you know, because if they know who I am, I know what they've been doing.
Yeah. Yeah, dad's a fun guy, that's for sure, man. And you know, so everybody knows, obviously, like Cheech and Chong, right? Everybody knows that you are half of Cheech and Chong, right? And most people will kind of equate that as like, you know, it's your movies and all that stuff. But I want to ask you about a movie that most people might not know that you were a part of. And I just want to get your thoughts on like what it was like to do this film. And that film is Ferngully.
Oh, Ferngully. Oh, yeah. That was a fun little cartoony.
You were the voice of what's the character?
There's two.
Was there two?
Yeah, Cheech was one. I was the other. What was it?
Root? Was it Root?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
something like that. That yeah. was cute. I turned down Lion King.
What?
Yeah, I turned that one down.
Why'd you do that?
It was Disney. I don't know if Ferngully was Disney too.
I believe it was.
But anyway, for some reason, well, Cheech and I had just broken up, and Cheech went, you know, he went with Don Johnson and that. I didn't want to, I thought that doing a Disney movie without being Cheech and Chong was, you know, I don't know what I was thinking. But anyway, I turned it down. And then I ended up doing Zootopia.
Zootopia, yeah. You won some awards for that too, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, the it won the Academy Award.
Right.
Yeah, that movie was great. Kids love it.
It was a great, great, great movie. No, it was Would I turn that down again? Lion King, probably. Jeff Katzenberg, you know, he was the head of Disney, or he was the head of one of the I got a history of Katzenberg. My mother had died in, I was on location in France, and my mother died, and then I flew back for her memorial, and I was on Vancouver Island. And the next morning, a knock on my door, and here's Katzenberg and what's his name? I can't think of the other guy. They found their way up to Vancouver Island to get me to be in a movie called It Came from Hollywood. So I knew Jeff right from the days of riding in a little Cessna plane, you know, back to L.A. or back to Seattle, and then a flight to L.A. And then, I don't know, when it came up, I just didn't feel like Cheech and Chong. I felt like Cheech and Chong were, you know, somehow selling out doing a Disney movie like that and not starring in it, you know. That was my whole thing, you know. When Cheech left, he left at the top of our career. You know, we had other movies planned, we had everything going, and they talked him into doing his own movie, Born in East L.A., and that was like the kiss of death for Cheech and Chong. You know, once you break up a winning hand like that, you know, there's no putting it back together again, and that's what happened. You know, we never did get back together. Until what, 20 years later, you know, and then it was only for a live show. You know, we still haven't done a movie yet together yet.
But you've had some bangers that you've been involved with. I mean, obviously everybody knows you were in That 70s Show, right? One of my favorites, Trailer Park Boys, right?
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of stuff that you've done that's been kick ass still. So.
And the thing is, I never compromised, you know, because that character, that Stoner character to me was groundbreaking, just like Cheech's character was groundbreaking, you know. I understand Cheech, you know, because Cheech's character was a bit, you know, a bit racist in some ways, you know, sort of like being that Chicano, although the Chicanos are the biggest fans of that.
Still genius. I mean, both of the characters, in my opinion, are fucking genius.
Yeah, hilarious. Yeah, and I hated to mess with it, you know, and then when Cheech became a cop, you know, but that's what his dad was a cop, and he did a great job on Nash Bridges, you know, but it just ended the Cheech and Chong thing, the role that we had going. Right. And I was directing and writing all the movies, and so when he stopped it, it was like he stopped my career, you know, of that. And I understand totally, you know, because Cheech really is a very talented individual, and he just disagreed with my approach. And what she did right from the beginning, you know, we neither one of us had anywhere else to go, so we couldn't walk out, you know. There, you know, I quit. I got nothing else happening. I understand totally. I really loved that character that Pedro that he played, you know. I mean, to me, that was to this day, it was such a game changer for the Chicano community and for the whole world, you know, because he humanized, and like we did with the weed, you know, we humanized it, you know, not only humanized it, but I made sure that the characters that we played were health nuts, you know. You show me making a drink, you know, and weightlifting, you know, doing with the weights, and then the only thing we did, you know, was get high and look for chicks, you know.
Well, I think that's really important, honestly, man. You know, the marijuana being criminalized, like that was the conspiracy that got me into questioning like why things are the way they are, right? So like, sure, you know, being as big as you were or and still are in that I don't know how you would say it, but in that genre, I guess, yeah, you know, yeah, you probably had a lot to do with the fact that people can go get medical marijuana right now. You know?
Totally.
So like, totally. That's super important.
Yeah, they put my ass in jail for a bong, you know? And the thing is, I could have beat it, but I realized that it was like a karate move, you know? They came at me and I just did the nicest sidestep and just showed them all how stupid, you know, that law was and is, and how ridiculous it was. That, and then all it did was, you know, the righteous people, they're not looking at me and they go, okay, well, that's where you're at, huh? You know, because they were trying to do that old play, you know, that old Nixon, you know, blame it on the hippies, you know, and it didn't work, and it'll never work anymore. In fact, there's no more hippies.
No, yeah. I was going to ask you something kind of along the lines of this. Like with a, you know, a career spanning as long as yours has, what was, when I talk to like people that are my dad's age or my grandpa's age, and they're say liberal or conservative, when you talk to them about anything that's going on in the world, they have a lot more in common, the older liberals and conservatives, than young liberals and conservatives have.
Totally.
Like you look at like Bill Maher or your Joe Rogan, and they're like older classical liberals. You look at older classical conservatives, and it's like, you're not that off from each other anymore. Nope. What that looked like to you? Like, how have you perceived that throughout the years?
Well, you know, like I said, we're put here to populate the planet, you know, and try not to mess it up while we're in that state, you know. It's just an age thing that people go through, and if you're here long enough, you know, you kind of understand that people do have to learn. Everybody has to learn. You know, and that's what's going on now. You know, there's, you know, what's going on now? It's funny. It's a media event, and Trump latched onto that right away, and he saw. So what he's doing? He's using the media and lies, and the fact that people will believe lies. You know, because it's much easier to believe a lie than to accept the truth, because a lot of times you're not prepared or intellectually prepared to accept, you know, what is really going down. And so blaming others or blaming something that is out. Well, you know, well, he did it first. And if you notice, whatever Trump gets blamed, he always blames the other guy first or at the same time. Like he said about the you know, everything that's going down, you know, the insurrection, the guys that are investigating the insurrection, he calls them con men. he calls them con man. And it's like, hold on there, sporty. It's what we're going through is an exercise in ignorance, and it's some people, they're sincerely ignorant, there's no doubt about it. My brother, he's passed away, but he was racist to the bone. And when I married a black girl, my first wife, he did his best to get in the way, in his own way. He, growing up with me, they knew that they couldn't change in the way I think. You know, I was too far out there. But what I found is that ignorance, it's a very common thing to have in the human race. And that's what we're up against now. We're up against the ignorance. And then it's the ones that do know the truth, the educated ones. Now, their dilemma is, how do we explain it to the ones that won't accept explanation? You know, how do you teach these people, you know? Well, you don't. They have to learn for themselves. And so the best you can do, that's why I said, this has been going on and will be going on. Now, I was given so many gifts in my mind, and, you know, musically, everything's been put at my disposal, just like this show, not so much to change anything, but to reassure people that there's a lot of people that think like I do and think the way you do, but because we're not, you know, we're in the flux, we're in the middle of this drama that's going on. And so it's hard to, you can't make conclusions. And like I said, what the ignorant do, they find somebody or something to blame for their problems. That way they say, it's not my fault. If it wasn't for these Mexicans sneaking across the border, if it wasn't for these Black guys trying to take over the world, if it wasn't for these the transgender trying to use a bathroom, you know, they can't make up their mind what bathroom to go to. All that weird shit that bothers the ignorant people, because they're not equipped to understand what's going on. And the reason is that they're new in school and they have to learn. And the best we can do, and that's why the older the sages get, and I'm becoming one of them, the less they talk. Because I had an old weightlifter buddy of mine, Zabel, and when I first came to LA, I joined the Gold's Gym right away, because I was a Gold's, you know, I read about it in magazines. It was like the place to be.
I was the Mecca.
Yeah, the Mecca. And I saw, and the first night I was working out there, this one guy was having a trouble, man. He was all doing the weight wrong, you know, he's picking it up wrong. He had no idea. Because when you join the gym, this is what they said, it's $25, no instruction, and put your weights away. And $25 for 3 months, it was a special. and so I went over to the guy and I tried to help him. Well, Zabel pulled me aside and he said, save your breath. And I looked at Zabel and I went to argue, and then he just gave me that look like,
let him learn.
Shut the fuck up. And so I said, okay, stay on your own towel. And so that's what, from that day forth, I won't, if someone asks me to help or ask me advice, I will give them, you know, nonstop. But if until someone asks, you know, it's like being on the show, you know, until someone asks, you know, I've learned to let people learn. And that's what's happening, you know. People have to learn on their own. And it's a bitter pill to swallow sometimes, you know.
I wish more people thought like you do.
Well, that's why I'm on the show, you know, because I'm unique in that way.
Yeah, that's a rare trait these days, it seems, for sure. Everybody's got to convince everybody else of whatever it is, you know. And I mean, I've been guilty of that too, but I have, in doing this show, kind of learned to, you know what, man? You know, like, if you want the information that we talk about, come get it. If you don't, fuck it.
There's room for it. I was on Joe Rogan, and I don't know if you heard that.
But absolutely, yes. I did.
but it almost, like, it took Joe's breath away. I had no idea, man. I thought he was like a fellow bodybuilder, you know, like me. And so after the show, he said, he said, let me show you my plates. And then he showed me, and he's a big old gym. And I said, so Joe, do you get a chance to work out here often? You know, and you say that to bodybuilders, it's a laugh. It's a joke, because that's all they do is work out, you know. And Rogan looked at me, he goes, oh, was that funny? Was that supposed to be funny? I said, whoa. And then I went to the fight after the Colin McGregor fight, and I had ringside seats too. And Rogan wouldn't look at me. He wouldn't look at me. I stared at his, I stared at him until he finally turned and gave me a little half nod, you know.
Oh no. Tommy Chong and Joe Rogan didn't get along after that one, I guess, huh?
No, he did not like what. Well, I just knocked the holes into all his theories, you know.
That's funny.
Like, he asked me about guns, and I thought, you know, guns are meant to kill. You know, if you got a gun, someone's going to die near you, you know, and it could be you.
You know, the thing is, man, like, we can all agree to disagree, I think. I think that's super important. I think that's something that most people in our society today just don't have the ability to do, right? Like, I'm sure, Tommy, you and I probably won't agree on a handful of things, right? Like, it's just, it is what it is. We're not all the same. But I think that there's a level of, like, respect you have to have for people who just don't agree with you, right? And you don't want to, like, force somebody, you know?
Totally. Stay on your own towel. You look at them and you see they're learning. Yeah. You know, they haven't evolved, you know. You look at the Catholic Church, or you look at the nuns, you look at the priest and that. And if you look at them and you look past their habits and their clothes and that, there's real people that are conflicted, that go through all sorts of mind trips and all sorts of spirituality trips and all that, you know. And they're conflicted. Everybody is. Everybody on earth, because we're here to learn. That's the whole point. And sometimes, you know, like with me, you know, when I found out the secrets, see, I got turned on by a jazz musician. His name was Sonny Greenwich. He plays guitar, and he's in Montreal. And one time, we had a little jazz club in the back of one of the clubs we had, and Sonny was playing, and then after he turned me on to a book called The Third Eye by T. Lobsang Rampa, and T. Lobsang Rampa was a guy from Britain that was reincarnated as a Tibetan, a monk, and he wrote about it. If you get a chance, check it out. The Third Eye by T. Lobsang Rampa. And in it, it tells you, the book tells you why how we're here physically, you know, how we're connected to a silver cord, and how that silver cord is connected to our over-self, and how the over-self is in charge of what we do while we're here on earth. And as long as that silver cord is connected, we're always connected to them. Now, when we die, that silver cord is severed. And then we our spirit goes right into the over self and then awaits the next reincarnation, you know, to come down. And while we're with the over self, we decide what life we've lived and what we're going to next, you know, what the next journey is going to be like. And so when I learned that real quickly, but in the band, so I got the books, I got his books, you know, that book, and then one book led to another. And so the drummer in my band, he thought, oh, he started collecting those spiritual books. He never read them. he just collected the book because that was his, that's how far he got, you know. Oh, Chung's got that book. Oh, I'm going to get that book. Yeah.
It's better than nothing. He started down the path.
Well, he never made it. He never made it, unfortunately. He found out that he was Native. That was another thing, you know. He was adopted. What a drummer. Oh, man, he was one of the best drummers in the world. And I can say that unequivocally, you know. But he was too loud at times because he would play loud for attention. Because he had the chops, he could make everybody leave the room, you know. but
he, might as well.
And when Cheech and I started making it big, you know, where one time I came out of a club Cheech and I had worked in Vancouver, and Ted, that was his name, he changed his name to Durst Maxwell, but Ted was waiting for me outside, and he got hostile. He was hostile. He says, you don't look up your old friends. You made it so big you can't talk to your old friends. And I know the guy's nuts, you know. So
don't you know who I am? I'm Jimi Hendrix.
No, it cracks me up, man.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's funny. Well, dude, listen, man, Tommy, I don't know about you, but an hour has already flown by for me. It seems like.
Oh, good.
It seems even like 30 minutes. What do you say, Charlie?
I can't believe it. I was like so captivated with the stories.
Yeah. Well, that's how you know.
Well, dragon. The whole entire day has been dragging. I'm like, come on, can it just be six? And now it's already.
What I'm. See, I've been given the secrets, and I'm, you know, if you've got me on a podcast, I will blab forever about the secrets, because I know it's not going to, those that have ears will hear, you know, and that's all that counts. All that counts. All the rest of them, you know, they're just whatever they're doing, you know, they're treading water or whatever they're doing, you know, they're here for a reason, and they're going to learn, you know. That's why, biblically speaking, you know, I was asked again by a friend of mine, one word, what's the word that would you would tell people to follow? And I didn't think about it at all. I said one word. It was forgiveness. Because that frees you. See?
It does.
See?
It's like not carrying around grudges and ill will and all that. It's like poison for you.
Yeah.
It's just a weight on your own back. And once you can just, and we're back. You know,
you do it in your mind. You do it with things. That's the other thing. I'll leave you with this one too. I did a little talk. They showed up in smoke, and at the film, at the USC Film Institute, and again, these filmmakers, they said, what is your secret sauce? You know, how did you, you know, no film experience at all, no film school, no high school. Forget film school. No high school. I couldn't make it past algebra. And then when I went to jail, I took a course. I was trying to get my GED in jail. And it came to algebra again. And I said, and so the prison said, well, just write down anything and we'll pass you anyway.
Nice.
And I said, yeah, great. I cheat on a jailhouse GED. That's something I'll proudly hang up on my wall.
Hey, you still made it. You still made it, man. It's all good.
No, the truth is, man, you know, learning, when like with me, it was a gift. I learned how to pray, and I'm serious. That's what I told the guy at USC. I said, God is only a thought away. And God is the most used word probably in both any language. And if you look at the Lord's Prayer, our Father, every word has meaning. Our Father, first of all, our Father, of all of us, our Father who art in heaven. He's in heaven. He's not on earth. He's in heaven. Hallowed be thy name. Right there. Hallowed be thy name. In other words, the word God, if used correctly with hallowed, if you make God, the word God, special, so special, that's the app that we all have. We all have a God app, but we can't just play with it and say, oh, my God, or whatever. You got to know that that word has power, meaning, everything. Everything is in that word. If you can manage to keep your thoughts, just your thoughts, on God, he will perfect that which concerns you. In other words, if you're a rapper, the lyrics will come. If you're an artist, the inspiration will come. If you're a writer, the words will come. Whatever concerns you, but your mind has to be on God, nothing else. Nothing else. Not on what you're going to lose, what you're going to get, but just what you want to do with your life. Put your mind on God, and that's easy to do. You think of God. Think of God. And by the last thing, I was in getting a physical, and my blood pressure was high. So the attendant, young guy, goes, okay, let's do that again. This time I want you to think nice thoughts. He said, just think nice thoughts. And so, of course, my mind went right to God. My blood pressure, perfect. Came out perfect.
Yeah, I went and got my blood drawn a couple of weeks ago, or about a month ago. And I was getting a little wheezy. I was thinking about God, but I thought I was going to meet him.
That's right. That's all you got to do, man. That's all you got to do. Because we represent God. And the reason we represent God is that he's so busy, you know. He's so evolved, you know, that in order to enjoy his handiwork, we're sent. That's what our job is. That's why, you know, of all the creatures on earth, and by the way, we all, our spirit goes into all the creatures too, by the way. You know, you could die, come back a whale, you can come back a shark, you can come back a monkey, you can come back a cockroach, you can come back as anything, because the spirit is, there's no substance. It can go into anything and everything. And it will, and it does, because we have eternity to deal with all this stuff. We're lucky right now because of the incarnation that we're in now. We can talk about this stuff, you know. Not too many creatures can do what we do, but a lot of creatures do. You know, when the birds are all flocked together, and they're all flying together, that's they're all connected. They're all connected. And that's and for happiness, we make our own happiness. And by the way, we live in a world of unhappiness.
Yeah.
Just so we know the difference.
That's deep, man. And yeah, dude, you're right. And what are the astronomical chances that the three of us would be humans right now with the ability to talk about this in this time period over the internet? Like, I'm sitting here talking to Charlie Creamer and Tommy Chong right now. Like, that in itself is some form of miracle, right? Like,
it is.
It's crazy. It is. It's a crazy universe we live in. Well, damn, dude, Tommy, listen, first of all, I just want to say that I greatly appreciate you spending time with us today. I've been looking forward to this for, I don't know, weeks now, right? So this is fucking amazing.
Well, let's do it again.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I would love to do this again one day and hear
anytime.
More. Yeah, absolutely, man. We'll set that up. I usually space the guests out, so I'm not just flooding the show with the same people over and over again. But, you know, a couple months down the road, we'll definitely reach out to you and set anytime. Something up. Looks like Creamer's camera just shut out. Can you still hear us, Creamer? Can we still hear you?
Yeah, you can.
Okay, cool. Okay. Anything you want to say, Creamer, before we kick Tommy off the show?
Hold on.
He said, hold on.
No, I can't see you either.
Yeah, okay. Well, Tommy, do you have anything that you want to plug before we boot you off here at all or anything?
You got no. You know, I've got you know, we're close to doing a public offering, you know, for Cheech and Chong cannabis. So we'll be on the stock market as soon as they, I imagine, as soon as they legalize it federally, you know, and when that happens, I'm quite sure that we'll be up there. Other than that, Cheech opened his new gallery in Riverside, California, and I'm going to be plugging that. It's pretty incredible. And that's about it. My wife and I are putting a little sort of a podcast together, you know, Chong and the Family Stone, it's called. And we'll show people how to get along.
Cool, man.
How to make it work.
I'll look forward to being a guest. I'll look forward to being your first guest on that show.
Oh, great idea.
You know,
I'll hook you up. Okay, guys.
Cool, Take care, man. All right, Tommy. Thank you, buddy.
Bye-bye.
Bye, man. Whoa. Bro. Wow.
That dude is unbelievable.
Bro.
Talk about anything, man.
And we're still recording because I just want to say whoa a few times. Again,
Tommy. Wow.
Yeah, dude, man.
I don't even know what to say.
I don't either, man. I mean, we just talked to Tommy Chong. I feel like a freaking superstar right now.
I felt like a book opened up and I got sucked into it.
Yeah.
I was just like, I was there, man. I was in London, England with him, you know. Yeah. And
hanging out with Jimi Hendrix.
He walks in. I could just see it with the purple and blue lights. I was like, I was there, dude. So sick.
Yeah, dude, that was awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely set that up again in the future. And, you know, yeah, that was cool. That was cool. Anyways, well.
Thanks for watching, guys. We got stuff coming on the Patreon start of next month. And yeah, I'm doing a read through the book of Revelation. I'm working on it, the formatting of it still, but should have several episodes up for Patreon. And yeah, it'll be dope. We'll go through that whole thing. And then who knows what we do after that, you know? But that'll be like, you know.
OnlyFans. OnlyFans.com/ShadowBanPodcast. Don't go to that link because it's not really a link, but it's still on my mind. Still thinking about it. Anyways. All right, schmucks. See you later.